And he works in mesoscopic systems and strongly correlated electron systems. And he's going to tell us today about anions, how to detect them, and even if they have a use.
Well, use is certainly a strong word, especially for a theorist, right? Anyway, I'm going to speak about work that was done in collaboration with some of my former and current students. I don't know what end of the stick is conventionally used here to point at transparencies. Okay, so now KT is my former student who made very nice contributions in the early stages of this project. So he is now at MIT and beginning his faculty job in Hong Kong soon. Pei Li is currently at Northwestern, and Chin-Chi Wang is at Brown now and made some very nice contributions to the later parts. And my other collaborators include Alexei Kitaev, Yuval Geffen, and Adi Shtep. Okay. So you may remember that in the fall 2008, there was a lot of panic in newspapers and a lot of excitement in the scientific community. So newspapers were in panic because of the terrible huge accelerator in Geneva, which was going to create terrible black holes which would consume our planet, right? And scientists were excited for exactly the same reason, that this huge accelerator would discover the smallest particles in the universe. But nicest thing happened because the accelerator broke down. However, this doesn't mean that the search for the smallest particles in the universe stopped. It was actually continued very successfully in condensed matter laboratories across the globe. And just around the time LHC broke down, a new very small particle whose charge is just one quarter of an electron was discovered. So clearly it's much smaller than anything LHC can bring, because even a quark has charge of one sort, right? So that's pretty impressive. But the most interesting thing about this particle is not even its charge. It's its statistics, because it appears that it's neither bosons nor fermion, but something much more interesting. And if our current suspicions are true, there may be even some use as in this title, in particular in quantum information processing. But now I made the statement that the particle is neither fermion nor boson. Obviously, that's not what is written in a standard quantum mechanics textbook, so it needs some clarification. Though I suspect that not in this audience, because, well, I don't know how many high-energy people are here, but quite a long time ago, high-energy theorists realized that in a two-dimensional world, you can have all kinds of particles other than bosons and fermions, and they even invented a name for them, which is exactly these, anions, because they can be anything else. So that was a nice observation, but just in two dimensions. And now again, I must apologize, but when I ask my string theory friends about the number of dimensions in the world, they all give me different numbers, like 11. No one ever told me that there are just two dimensions. And this means that all fundamental particles have to be fermions and bosons only. On the other hand, in condensed metaphysics, it's not that easy to find a system with 11 dimensions, but two-dimensional systems are known. These are just thin films. And then we may ask about the statistics of elementary excitations in those systems. And the answer is that at least theory predicts that some of them are anions indeed. And certainly this is just a theoretical prediction. There is no such thing as a direct experimental evidence of anionic statistics. But nevertheless, in the simplest case of so-called abelian anions, we have so much indirect evidence that we are pretty confident they exist. As far as more interesting and less famous, I can put it, non-abelian anions, we are not so sure. But that's the most interesting question in the field for many reasons, and in particular because of their very interesting potential applications in quantum information technology. And this talk will be very much about our current search for those non-abelian particles. Okay, so now my hope was that I would really skip the introduction, because the colloquium by Eduardo Fradkin was just supposed to cover the introduction section of my talk. But unfortunately, he changed his topic at the last moment, and these two transparencies he showed as the introduction to my talk, as he told, is really not enough. So unfortunately, I will have to spend much of my time on this introduction. And first of all, I will have to remind what we mean by fractional statistics, because I don't think it was really in the talk. Then I certainly need to speak a little bit about quantum Hall physics, because that's where we expect to see all these nice anions. And finally, about non-abelian anions in particular. And then I will switch to the detection part,
which will cover all kinds of things, interferometry, tunneling, and the last topic, some fluctuation dissipation theorem, which is valid in this class of systems far from equilibrium. Okay, but the first thing goes first. So what about fractional statistics? What about these anions? We know very well what fermions and bosons are. When we exchange two fermions, the wave function changes its sign. When we exchange two bosons, nothing happens at all. Now, that's a very simple thing, but since I want to distinguish fermions and bosons on one hand from everything else on the other hand, let me consider a different thought experiment. Just one particle makes a full circle around another particle. And then, certainly, just nothing happens in both cases. For bosons, obviously, and for fermions, again, minus times minus gives plus, because these are just two consecutive particle exchanges. Very simple. Now, how can I define anions? I simply tell that, okay, I run one particle around the other, make a full circle, and then something happens to the wave function. The simplest thing would be that it just picks up some phase. So that's my definition of anions. And certainly this definition doesn't look very different from the definition of bosons and fermions, especially when I can define what happens to my wave function just in terms of this phase. And then one could wonder, so in this room, everything is made of bosons and fermions, right? I'm not sure there is a single anion here. So why such a huge difference? A difference is really huge. So I myself didn't even believe in anions until I once went to a bookstore and saw a book written by Janet Anion. So now I know there is at least one anion, and her name is Janet. Okay, but really, why anions are so rare? Now, unfortunately, my explanation is cut by this screen, and this shows that there's a true puzzle which escapes people who don't have imaginations that could continue the picture. But I'm sure everyone here is an imaginative person enough, so we can understand what's going on. Now, what I consider here is exactly the same thought experiment. One particle goes around the other, picks up some phase or something, and that's what happens with anions. Or I can run a particle around empty space. Then nothing is supposed to happen. Then let's ask, when it really makes sense for me to distinguish these two situations in two dimensions, certainly it makes perfect sense. I cannot deform this picture into this picture, but in three dimensions, it's a problem, because I can just raise this circle a little bit, move it parallel to this transparency, and put it back. And so then it would be very strange for me to expect any difference between these two situations. They can be continuously deformed into each other. This is nicely compatible with the picture here, that nothing happens when I make a full circle, but it's not compatible with anions. So that's the explanation why they're so rare. We have too many dimensions here. It's not like people need to add 11 more dimensions. It's like we need to remove one more, have only two. Then we can look for anions. And this leads to the next question. Where do I have two dimensions? And one nice situation is quantum Hall effect. And this is a situation where people are really looking for anions, and the situation where we had most advances so far. So we consider a two-dimensional electron gas of the type Eduardo Fradkin mentioned, so very clean, very narrow film, very strong magnetic field. Well, not that strong, but a few Tesla, and very low temperature. And in this condition, something interesting happens. So, well, when we have a magnetic field, we know that the ordinary Hall effect takes place, which is a very simple phenomenon. The current doesn't really run in the direction of the electric field because there is a Lorentz force, and magnetic field results in the deviation of the current from the direction of the electric field. That's simple. In this class of systems, this effect goes to its extreme. So all current goes exactly perpendicular to the electric field. So that's interesting, but that's not the most interesting part of the story. The most interesting part of the story is the relation between the current and the voltage. And the current is the whole current that runs in the direction perpendicular to the field. Now, this certainly looks like usual Ohm's law, but an interesting thing is this prefactor, because it's just a product of some rational number, which we call the filling factor, and the combination of the square of the electric charge and the Planck constant, so only universal constants. And now I'm sure in this place people constantly see just combinations of universal constants, right? But I'm not speaking about high energy physics. I'm speaking about solid state physics, where everything depends on everything. The material of your sample, shape, disorder, size, absolutely everything. And a million of things people even didn't think about. But not here, For some reason, I have just this universal combination, E squared divided by H, in solid state physics of all things. And not only I have just universal constants here, even the numerical value is extremely simple and easy to remember. It's just one Klitzing, who's shown in this picture. Okay, so that's the playground for the story. And now what actually happens is conveniently classified in terms of this filling factor nu, in terms of the conductance. Nu can be an integer. So a bunch of possible values of nu are shown in this picture. So you see all kinds of numbers. That's a famous picture. It doesn't show many of the known numbers. Doesn't really matter. Some of them are integers, like 1, 2, 3, 4 in this picture. In this case, all physics can be understood from a very simple model of non-interacting electrons, which is nice, because frankly speaking, solid-state theorists like me can do only one problem, non-interacting electrons. But it is also very disappointing, because you obviously cannot get any anions when you start from non-interacting electrons. All you can get are those non-interacting electrons, and they are fermions. So that's where we end up. Now there is another situation. The nu is anything but an integer number. In this situation, non-interacting electrons are just absolutely unable to explain what's going on, which may be great news for the search of anions, but is a disaster from the point of view of any reasonable condensed matter theorist. The best thing we can do is weak interactions. So how can we approach this problem? As it turned out, we can, and Laughlin did it in an extremely powerful way when the filling factor is just 1 divided by an odd number. So his approach was simple and solved the problem completely. He guessed the correct wave function, right? It's very fast. You don't spend time on derivations. You just write down the answer, and the answer is correct. You know everything, right? That's the best approach to physics. And then when you have that, you can calculate everything too. In particular, you can calculate the charge of your elementary excitations. This Laughlin did it, and he discovered that for these filling factors, 1 divided by an odd number, the charge is the product of the filling factor and the electron charge, which is smaller than an electron. It's a little bit crazy, but it took some time, and eventually in the late 90s, people were able to observe these fractional charges experimentally. As a result, Laughlin immediately got a Nobel Prize in physics. Experimentalists didn't get anything. Okay, anyway, fractional charges are around. Next question, fractional statistics. What happens when I run one charge around another? This was addressed by Arovas, Schlieffer, and Wilczek, and their result was also quite unusual. It's neither bosons nor fermions. You get a non-trivial phase. This nu is not integer. So they're anions. That's great. The problem, however, is that up to now, no experimental group was able to confirm this by direct experimental observation. And the result is that both Schlieffer and Wilczek got their Nobel Prizes for completely unrelated work. Now, before I proceed to the next transparency, I just want to make one brief comment that there is a nice way to understand all these fractional statistics invented by Wilczek, which doesn't require any fractional statistics. So let me think of these particles as fermions or bosons. But let me also attach a very narrow solenoid to each particle, and then I cannot produce three-dimensional transparencies, but the solenoid is really perpendicular to this screen. Now, if I select a correct magnetic flux through the solenoid, it must be actually a flux quantum, the Planck constant divided by the electron charge, then I discover exactly the same phase accumulated by one particle moving around another just from the Aronoff-Bohm effect, because certainly it gets a phase associated with the magnetic field. So that's what I get. Okay, so that's a way to understand everything without fractional statistics, but it is there, really. So all this is nice, but has one major drawback. What I really discussed describes nicely states this number nu, which is 1 divided by an odd number, and can in fact be generalized relatively straightforwardly to all kinds of other filling fractions with odd denominators. And the simplest view of quantum Hall effect is that you don't need anything else. In fact, when I was preparing this talk, I tried to steal some images on Wikipedia. I didn't find good images, but I did find a statement in the quantum Hall article that quantum Hall effect is observed at filling factors nu with an odd denominator. It was fixed later, so apparently someone other than a graduate student reviewed the article. But the truth is that we do have exactly two filling factors with an even denominator, 5/2 and 7/2. The physics of 7/2 is not understood even compared to the physics of 5/2, so I will not speak about that. But what's going on with 5/2? Actually, it's believed that the physics is connected, so there are some very strange experiments which would suggest otherwise. But I will not speak about 7/2. So what is going on at FiveHub? Any attempt to generalize Laughlin's picture straightforwardly fails. So the first thing is that we don't understand what's going on. And then the second thing, as always with theorists, is that suddenly we can invent all kinds of theories. And the theory which appears to be most promising at this stage is Moore-Reed theory, which predicts something pretty funny. So as far as the charge of elementary excitations goes, it's just one quarter of the electron charge. There's unusual, but it's the usual, unusual thing with quantum Hall effect. It's always fractions. But what is really interesting is the statistics. When you run one particle around another, you not only change the wave function. Changing the wave function is an extremely subtle effect because it's the same quantum state, actually. This number doesn't have much physical meaning. What you have here, you don't just get a number here, FS. You get a completely different quantum state. And this automatically means that when we fix positions of two particles, then when you fix the positions of two particles, then you must have more than one quantum state. Otherwise, making a circle, you would have to come from your initial state back to your initial state behalf to some phase. And that's exactly what Moore and Reed suggest. So if we consider two anions with charge one quarter, you have two states. In one state, the particle makes a circle and nothing happens. It's just like bosons and fermions. But in the other state, a particle makes a circle and you get a minus sign. That's like a regular abelian anions. But now you could combine these two states. That's exactly what is written in this last half equation. So again, I think people need some imagination. But what I'm doing, I'm adding this and this. And then to be very careful, because you are not allowed to add them, I have something else that's completely not seen. But the bottom line is that when I combine this and this and run one particle around the other, one half of my wave function doesn't change. The other half gets a minus sign. And altogether, I produce an orthogonal state. So that's clearly something different. That's what we call non-abelian statistics. Now, how do I describe the behavior of such non-abelian system? If I want a full picture, I certainly need to know a lot about the system. But crude features can actually be understood in a very simple language by introducing a quantity we call a topological charge. So it takes just three values on this particular example because it's simple. It can be vacuum. It can be fermionic topological charge, which we call epsilon, or it can be what we call sigma, related to the spin operator in the talk by Eduardo Franchi, but I will not do any spin transformations. Will not do any mapping on sizing model. Now, these are just symbols, and basically, if the number of particles is even, it can be 1 or epsilon. If it's odd, it's always sigma. In particular, there's a topological charge of any single particle. And then, if I know that, I can always tell what happens when I run one particle around a bunch of others. So if I know the topological charge inside the circle, and I know the combined topological charge inside the circle and on the circle, I can tell what phases I accumulate when I run around. They're written here. Not all of them can be seen, but that's no big deal. I will not read them from transparency anyway, because by the time we may need them, everyone is going to forget them anyway. So anyway, that's what we have. Now, that's certainly not the full story, because I also need to tell what happens when I combine a few particles. I need to have some algebra for these topological charges. And again, experts on conformal field theory can easily recognize some equations known for the Isaac model, but I will not enter such analogies. The point is that rules are generally very straightforward, but there is one subplot. I combine two quasi-particles with charge sigma, and I don't know what I get. I can get one, and I can get epsilon. That's a source of a lot of richness in this story. Now, that defines a state. Now, why people are so excited about that? Well, people are excited because that's very new. That's unusual. We don't have this type of statistics in everyday life. And besides, these are the smallest particles in the universe, right? In elementary particle physics, you cannot have things that small anyway. So it's something really exciting. But funding agencies recently also became excited because they got convinced that there's a nice way to build memory for quantum computers. Now, why? Let me take two such particles. As I explained, there are two states. So that's a qubit, right? Now, if such simple logic worked, then certainly funding agencies would be excited about any two-level system, as electron spin, nuclear spin, any electron in a trap, anything. And if it has more than two states, they would be even more excited because you pump more information when you have more than two levels, right? But they are not for a very fundamental reason. In most situations, we have a lot of interaction, or very little, doesn't matter, really, interaction with the outside world. When it's a lot, when it's little, it's all the same thing. It erases information, and it's very problematic how we fight this, even when the interaction with the outside world is very weak. What is interesting about this story, we don't care about the interaction with the outside world. It may be there, doesn't change anything. And the reason is that I never specified what the size of the system is. I can put my two anions 1 meter apart, and this will be perfectly fine. And still I have two states. And by the way, what it means, these two states are not combined from the states of anions, because I have two states for two particles. If this was just a product of the number of states for one and the second, each of them would have square root of two states, which is completely ridiculous, even though mathematical framework of the theory pretty much operates as if it were the case. But physically, clearly, you cannot have square root of two states for a particle. What you have two states for a whole system. And this really means it's a whole system, which is 1 meter big. And when we think of interaction with the environment, it's inevitably local. It just cannot erase information that sits on a system that is 1 meter long. The result is that this is a perfect memory, which is known as topologically protected memory. Now, one could play some other games here and even build a full quantum computer, but not out of this simple example of a non-abelian state, so I'm not really going to enter into discussion, in part because these nice states which were proposed as the feeling factors 12-5 and 13-5 do not seem to be confirmed by a very recent experiment, which was posted on CONMA just a few days ago. So no one knows where that experiment goes and what other experiments would tell, but I will not enter into other feeling factors anyway. With this feeling factor, you don't build a quantum computer as a whole, but you do build a very nice memory. That's already great. But then you build it if you have that state. Do we have it or not? And as I mentioned, theorists are very good in inventing a lot of theories when experimentalists want just one. That's what happened here. Eventually, a whole bunch of suggestions was made. Some of them have only abelian statistics. Others have non-abelian statistics. And now there is a question. How are we going to distinguish all this stuff? And one thing we could do, and one thing that was actually done, is to measure the electric charge. The electric charge of the excitation was measured to be 1/4. This agrees with the theory I just described. The problem is that it agrees with absolutely all theories of this state. That's one thing on which they all agree. So it doesn't help us even a little bit. What else can we see? There are some relatively crude things, like, say, what is the total polarization, which would discriminate some states. Unfortunately, it's not enough to tell if the state is abelian or non-abelian, and that's the most interesting thing in the story. But even with that, there is a lot of controversy experimentally. Right now, there are three sorts of experimental groups. Some tell that the spin polarization is 100%, others tell that it's 0, and others tell that it's something in between. There is one group that does two different types of experiments. One experiment shows 100 polarization, the other shows 0. So that's pretty much a mess. And on top of that, that's not going to tell you anything about statistics. So how do we find statistics? And when we think about that, we realize that, well, statistics is defined in terms of particles running around each other in circles. So if we want to know statistics, we need to run particles around each other in circles, which leads to the idea of interferometry. So the simplest interferometry idea is illustrated here. You just put a particle here, and then you run to another particle so that it can go this way or this way, and its two trajectories can interfere. Very nice. Would have nice signatures of non-abelian states. Great. The only problem with this is it's unlikely to work. And there's a bunch of reasons why it's unlikely to work. One reason which was realized pretty much immediately after this was put forward is an unfortunate fact that this world is not ideal. No matter how many dimensions it has, it's full of disorder, fluctuations, and everything else. But this interferometry proposal can possibly work only if the topological charge trapped inside this region doesn't fluctuate. And then one can tell, okay, we have some energy parameter here, the gap for excitations, we know it. It's a few hundred millikelvin. It's pretty low, but it's something. Now, a typical temperature for experiments is some 10 millikelvins. What you get is some exponent of this ratio, which is ridiculously small number, so you should not care. The problem is that this logic is wrong. First of all, what really determines formation of excitations here is not a gap of an ideal uniform system. This gap is what we see when we measure electrical resistance of the system, but what is present actually a whole bunch of states due to enormous disorder, which is there. So states are very clean, but very clean in solid state physics still means that there is a lot of disorder. And the relevant energy parameter is, well, quite much lower than this, say, 300 millikelvin gap. But even this is not the worst thing, because I was tacitly assuming that what changes the topological charge in the bulk of the thing is a charged particle of this charge 1/4. But this is a rich system. It has actually neutral particles whose gap is much lower. When you add localized states, you have a much lower energy parameter. The result is that you expect crazy fluctuations. You're not going to see anything. This problem can still be fixed in principle by going all the way to, say, zero temperature. Not that experimentalists are happy to hear that. But then there is another problem. We want to actually be able to distinguish all proposed theories, or at least abelian from non-abelian theories. As it turns out, the thing cannot distinguish some of the non-abelian states, like the Fafian I described, from the abelian state known as the 331 state, invented by Bert Halpern some time ago. And that's really bad, because even if you overcome all difficulties, you end up with nothing. So what can we do? As it turns out, you can change the geometry so that both problems miraculously disappear. You can distinguish all states, and you don't worry about fluctuations. And the second thing probably appears quite strange, because it's pretty obvious that when something fluctuates, interferometry is killed. That's what we know from optics. But as I will try to convince you, there is a rather miraculous setup, so-called electronic Mach-Zehnder interferometer, which takes care about this problem. So, okay, so what is this miraculous setup? So it's illustrated here. That's a nice STM picture, how it should look. That's the most schematic picture, and I will try also to make a picture on a blackboard, because it's not a completely trivial setting. So what's going on? So I start with a quantum Hall system that fills a half space. Then what I have here is the edge, and as was discussed and talked by Eduardo Fratin, I will come back to this point, nothing really propagates in the bulk. But charge can run from this source to this drain. So that's what I have along the edge. It's boring physics. Nothing really is going on here. Next, I can make a hole. I can make a hole here. This introduces another edge. Again, nothing interesting. I can introduce some source and drain here in addition. So things run from this source to this drain. Doesn't really matter. Finally, I can put some gates and create tunneling contacts. So tunneling contacts, the gates are seen here. Tunneling contacts are underneath. You cannot see them. This ans head actually exactly corresponds to the source of drain. It connects the system with the outside world. And then we can see the charge can tunnel from here to here and from here to here. So what I have is the following situation. Charge starts from source 1, tunnels here, goes along the edge, and ups in drain 2. Or it can go from source 1, tunnel here, and end up in drain 2. We have two trajectories. Interference between them is possible, so we can try to play with this. And now, what happens in the simplest case of the integer quantum Hall effect when all that is involved are just electrons? It's a very simple story which can be understood quite easily. So imagine that I have some weak tunneling here, amplitude gamma 1, some weak tunneling here, amplitude gamma 2. We know that the probability is just the square of the amplitude. If I had just one contact, all charge would travel through that contact. The probability of the tunneling event from each electron would be proportional to gamma 1 square. I would get something like that. If I only had the second contact, then I would get something like that. And then on top of that, I have some interference from, because certainly two trajectories, the one that goes through gamma 1 and the one that goes through gamma 2, they speak to each other. And then there is some phase. This phase is the Aaron of Bohm phase. There is some magnetic flux through this hole. When a particle makes a full circle around the hole, it accumulates the Aaron of Bohm phase. Exactly the same phase is the phase difference between a particle moving along the lower red line and the upper red line in this picture. So that's what I get. It's pretty simple. It's periodic and magnetic flux. This was actually observed. So pretty nice. Now, what changes if I go to more interesting fractional quantum Hall states? At first sight, frankly speaking, nothing changes. The particle has a fractional charge now, so it accumulates less of the Aaron of Bohm phase. What I need to write here is a correction factor proportional to the charge of a particle. Say if the charge is one third of an electron, I write one third here. So I get an expression of exactly the same structure. just the periodicity is different, not one flux quantum. The flux quantum here is, again, Planck constant divided by the electric charge. I have three flux quanta. So everything is simple. In fact, this was confirmed, this very simple argument was confirmed by an exact solution of a model of this interferometer at some point. So everything looks very straightforward. No any real difference from the previous setup I described. All the same issues, very few advantages, much harder to make, so who cares? But there is one problem here. So one of my favorite books is Principles of Solid State Physics by Zeyman. And in its preface, it tells that nothing is more practical than a rigorous mathematical theorem. Now, there is a rigorous mathematical theorem here. Imagine that we have a device with a hole in it. Now, there is a statement, Byers-Young theorem, which is actually pretty old. I think it's right 50 years now. The theorem is the following. If you have such a device and you change the magnetic flux through the hole, the current must be a periodic function of the flux. But the period has to be one flux quantum or lower. The smallest period cannot be greater than that. The mechanism of the theorem is actually extremely simple. When one electron makes a full circle around one flux quantum, it accumulates the phase of 2 pi. So it just cannot see one flux quantum. You change it by one flux quantum, you cannot change the current. That's it. No way. It's gauge invariance. When we look at this expression, clearly it's not the case. The periodicity is wrong. So something is wrong both with simple physical argument and with the exact solution. Now, what is wrong with the exact solution is subtle, but what is wrong with the physical argument is actually easy to understand. So again, as you see, I am completely operating on the hand-waving operator, which Professor Fratkin introduced in his colloquium. But as it often happens, this operator produces better results than a lengthy calculation. Because you always need to write a model first. And that is done by hand-waving operator, right? And if the operator is in the wrong eigenvalue, then all rigorous calculations would make no sense. So let me try to use that operator carefully then. So what's going on? When we first think about that, clearly this is the right probability for the tunneling of a particle. Okay, it can go through this contact, I get gamma 1 square. It can go through this contact, it gives me gamma 2 square. Or I can have interference of two trajectories. And that's exactly the Aaron of bomb phase I accumulate. No way around that. But as it turns out, that's a wrong tunneling probability for the second particle. And I cannot really get my current by multiplying this probability by the charge of a particle. And this happens because we completely forgot about the statistics. Each particle, when it emerges, it has a solenoid attached in my state with spinning factor one sort. So it may go away in the drain, disappear. Its charge is absorbed by the drain. It's probably screened. Even if it's not, it's fine. We don't care. Coulomb force is long range, but not that long range. However, this solenoid is an extended object. And so it will protrude through this hole in the interferometer forever. And hence, from the point of view of the second tunneling particle, the magnetic flux it sees is different, is the sum of the actual magnetic flux and this additional flux quantum. So I have a different tunneling probability. And then for the soft particle, I have even different probability because I have two flux quanta protruding through the hole. And only for the soft particle in this story, for the first particle in this story, this feeling factor one soft, I will finally get the same tunneling probability. So I have many of them. Which actually leads to a question how we determine the current. And the question is, in fact, now that's certainly not a university, so you don't have such people as pre-medical students. But at Brown, we do have a lot of them. They all take our most introductory physics class, and that class decides who of them is going to be a doctor, because they need to get an A. And A is given to those who can solve the following problem. There is a car. It has different speed limits on different paths of the road. What is the medium? What is the average velocity? So that's what makes a doctor. And the answer is certainly the harmonic average of those velocities. Not the arithmetic average. If it were arithmetic average, this device would be really bad. But it's a harmonic average. And the result is that what, again, it's not, it cannot be seen very well, but what you get here, if you again apply some imagination to the cutoff in this slide, you get the current, which is the harmonic average of several incorrect answers you would get from the exactly solvable model. Which is certainly a rather funny expression, because it depends non-analytically on my small tunneling amplitudes on both of them. So clearly, it's not that easy to get it by any calculation. And in fact, we got it by resumming an infinite number of the orders of perturbation theory. In some particular situations, at some particular choice of the set of parameters, the problem is actually exactly solvable via Bethe ansatz, and you again get the same story. But the point is that certainly your model is not must be correct. What was the issue with incorrect exactly solvable model? I mentioned that everything was nice there. People use a completely standard prescription in the field known as Venn's hydrodynamic theory, which normally works perfectly well, but not here. He had produced a Hamiltonian which was non-local. Its distant paths didn't commute with each other, so all physics was wrong. And what was actually lost was fractional statistics. Now, if you do things correctly here, you do get this harmonic average, which, by the way, means that we already have a quantum computer, good for one thing only, calculation of harmonic averages. And also it means that you can play with this expression, derive some scaling relations for the flux-dependent, flux-independent paths of the current, so on, get some conditions which would test if you really have an abelian statistics, and so on. But that's not a very interesting part of the story, because we are actually quite confident that abelian statistics is there, and it will be like a Foucault pendulum for the demonstration of the rotation of the Earth. A much more interesting question is how we can use the thing to demonstrate non-abelian statistics. Well, again, here all references are really cut off. There are many more of them than just this one, but there's something that cannot be fixed with imagination, so I apologize. That's what happens to these slides. Don't know why. Okay. But whatever is cut off, let me explain how one can approach this problem. So actually, it's a very interesting question, and I could run till the end of my talk discussing that, but I really want to speak about some newer results. So I will be brief here. I will also explain other reasons why I want to be brief here. So anyway, what one can do? The first thing is certainly always to measure the current, or IV curve. And in non-abelian state, this IV curve turns out to be asymmetric, so this interferometer is a diode. In other words, it's something useful for industry, even if you have no quantum computing. So that's pretty nice, but unfortunately, there is this nasty 331 state. And this nasty state, also produces a diode out of this device. So looking at the asymmetric IV curve is not enough. We need to look at something else. And then what we are going to look at is the noise. So basically, as I mentioned, noise is something that damages a regular interferometer. In a regular interferometer, if there is any fluctuation of the trapped charge, the signal is smeared. It doesn't happen here because the system runs in circles. So even if some trapped charge, particle emerges here, you will still run in the same circles, and you can see that your answer doesn't change much. But I can ask about a different type of noise. I can ask about the current that just goes from my source to the drain, and I may ask how this current fluctuates. So that's a formal definition of what we know as the low-frequency short noise, and it turns out that when current is small, it's extremely convenient to parameterize it in the form of what is called a Schottky formula. So I represent the noise as the product of the current times some effective charge. Now, why is this nice? That's nice because this effective charge tends to be the carrier charge. In fact, Schottky measured the electron charge this way. He took an electron bulb, studied the noise in that bulb, used that formula, extracted the charge of an electron. The same essentially trick was used to discover particles with charge 1/4 in 2008. But now, in my interferometer, life turns out to be much richer. It turns out that this prefactor, which we call Fan effector, or in other words, this effective charge, it actually depends on the applied magnetic field. And it tends to be pretty large, much greater than the charge of a single particle. This even happens in the simplest abelian state, but in that case, your effective charge never exceeds one electron charge. In non-abelian states, like the Pfeiffian state I described, it becomes pretty large. Now, how does this come? That's actually pretty simple physics. So imagine, again, that I consider the example from the previous transparency, a Laughlin state with some filling factor, some mu. So what happens? A particle jumps from this state to this state, the very first particle, then another one tunnels, another one, and so on. And in general, they just go in circles. But I can imagine a situation when I changed the magnetic field and tuned one of these tunneling probabilities I had on the previous slide, I tuned it to be small. And then what happens after a bunch of tunneling events, I am suddenly stuck in this point and wait for a very long time because this probability is small. Then finally I tunnel. Then again, a bunch of particles goes. And so what really happens, they tunnel in bunches. And the number of particles in the bunch actually equals just the number of segments on this trajectory. When I count everything, I see that what I get is the noise corresponding to one electron charge. So that's the story here. In non-abelian states, a similar diagram becomes much more complicated because of my fusion rules, which were on one of the previous transparencies. The meaning is that when one quasi-particle tunnels, I cannot always predict my topological charge, so I can go in different states. And then again, if I tune my magnetic flux such that, say, this tunneling probability becomes small, what's going on is a pretty funny story. So I go in circles here, but now after I'm stuck here, I don't have to follow exactly the same circle all the time. I can make a few smaller circles here. And after I do that, at some point I arrive here, wait, tunnel, and then again make a few smaller circles. The bottom line is that I can transmit a very big charge between such events when I'm stuck. So it goes a really huge burst. That's how I get this big filling factor, this big fan factor. So that's what's going on. This fan factor is unique for each state. That's a pretty nice way to distinguish all of them. And you will always know what your statistics is from this single number. So that's a great thing. Now, I could spend actually the rest of this talk discussing what's going on there because, well, both my group and later other groups did quite a lot of work on this interferometer. That's a very rich device with a lot of interesting things for a theorist. But I really don't want to go there for two reasons. One reason is that I want to speak about newer stuff. And the other reason is that what looks simple for a theorist doesn't look simple for an experimentalist. So they have too many issues. And then for a theorist, okay, you need to go with interferometry. How else you can check the statistics? You need to run particles and circles around each other. And then we have just two setups, Fabry-Pirot, which I described first, and Mach-Zehnder. Fabry-Pirot has issues, so we are stuck with Mach-Zehnder. There is just nothing else we could possibly do. But then you come to experimentalists, and they have so many issues. And you tell them, okay, why wouldn't you put a gate closer to your, a top gate closer to your sample? And they just look at you like an idiot. How could they do that? Maybe if they got a grant for $10 million, they could, but they don't have such grant. It's not like LHC, right? So people discover new particles here, but the scale is 3 or 4 orders of magnitude less money than anything that goes in discovering nothing in LHC. So it's a very different story. So the bottom line is that if they got resources of LHC, they would certainly put this top gate where I want and do a lot of other things. But they don't, so it's all problematic for them. They want me to show something much simpler. And then one would first think that nothing simpler is possible, but life is more interesting than that. And that's what I want to discuss. You can actually test statistics without interference. And this emerges because of the phenomenon of charge statistic separation. So what's going on? Let me come back to this issue of transport in quantum Hall systems. So let me think of a very simple classical model, some uniform magnetic field and a bunch of electrons flying there. We know that electrons are going to run in circles in this magnetic field, so they will essentially stay in one particular place, each of them, where the circle is relocated. But when I go close to the edge of the sample, it's more interesting. An electron tries to complete a circle, but cannot. It hits the edge, it's reflected, it goes here, then it's reflected, it goes here, then it's reflected, and so on. So at the end of the day, it propagates along the edge in this direction. Now, one can write down some Lagrangian, again, of pretty much the same type we saw in the colloquium today, chiral Lattice liquid model, or in other words, Wien's hydrodynamic action. So everything is nice, and that thing fully describes the physics of integer quantum Hall effect. In fact, there is a minor modification that would fully describe Laughlin states. But when I go to non-abelian states, my life becomes much more interesting because one such mode is just not enough. It has all information about the charge, but I also have statistics on the problem. And in order to describe statistics, I need some additional fields, which may be quite exotic. For example, for this Pfaffian state I discussed, as well as for some other closely related states, you get Majorana fermions, which are really funny particles because their creation and annihilation operator is the same. So in the talk by Eduardo Fratkin, they emerged as a technical tool in the situation where there is no true physical meaning to them, but in non-abelian states, they are around. All information about statistics actually is sitting there. And now, what is great? And what is very important for us, all these modes have different velocities. This would never transcribe from a purely field theoretic work on this stuff, because people love to use conformal field theory, and then everything must have the same speed on the edge. But the truth, the real truth, is that the conformal field theory never described these systems. Speeds are different. And they may be so different that particles of different types, that is charge and statistics, go in the opposite directions. Even that may happen. Your information about charge goes one way, your information about statistics goes the opposite way. Or at the very least, they have different velocities. And so one can ask how we can probe those different velocities. And from that, learn what states we have around. What is the structure of the edge, and hence what is the structure of the bulk. Now, there are several approaches to these, and I will speak about some of them. Now, one approach is connected to experiments which are currently attempted by Amir Jacobi group at Harvard. Now, this is called momentum-resolved tunneling. So what's going on? Imagine that I have two samples. For example, two quantum Hall samples. This picture illustrates two samples with different filling factors, 5/2, the one I'm interested in, and 2. So now, both of them have actually a bunch of the modes on the edge. Like this simple integer filling factor has 2 with spin up and spin down, and this fractional edge has a whole bunch, the same 2 spin up and spin down modes as the integer edge, plus an additional charge mode, plus an additional Majorana fermion. Now, tunneling occurs. And then we know that 2 things must happen in tunneling. One is that energy is conserved, but then there is another thing. Momentum is also conserved. Well, certainly momentum is conserved because of translational invariance. In this picture, there is invariance in the direction of these arrows. There is no translational invariance in the perpendicular direction, and moreover, there is no translational invariance in the direction perpendicular to the screen, because everything is very narrow. But then, as I hopefully convinced you, all physics of these quantum Hall systems is essentially one-dimensional, so I don't care. I can confidently claim, if I have nice straight edges here, then both energy and momentum conserve. Which certainly means that what I can possibly see if charge can tunnel between these two things is very restricted and very informative. Well, one obvious thing is that I don't get any current and I have no voltage difference between these two guys. That's just thermodynamics. You have no voltage, you have no current. But if you have small finite voltage, you are still not going to have any current. So that's a more interesting thing. And when you finally begin to have current, you get some information from that. And then there are some additional features when you increase your voltage or do something else to the system. So that's what's going on. Now, let me explain how this comes to life. That's actually a pretty standard technique in other branches of solid-state physics, but here it can be more informative than usual because of this nice one-dimensional restriction. So what's going on? Now, let me look at this picture, which is extremely simplistic and addresses just tunneling between two edges with a single mode on each of them, say two situations when the filling factor is 1. So this line is a dispersion relation for one edge. So I have momentum k, I have energy e, and the slope of this line tells me what the velocity is. I have another branch of elementary excitations on another side of my tunneling barrier. So here it is. Again, it's straight line here because I'm interested in small energies and k's. And again, k goes this way, energy goes this way. The slope is the velocity, which has the opposite sign in this particular picture because I can see the systems where I have contrapropagating modes. So that's what I see. And then these circles show field states. At low energies, at high energy states are empty. The same is here. So that's what's going on. Now, that's not very interesting as it is. So in my initial situation, when just states with negative energy are filled here and here, and states with positive energy are empty here and here, nothing is going on. No current is obviously possible. Interesting things happen when I shift those curves. And now the question is, how can I shift them? There are two ways. One which is less practical, but which is already shown in this picture, because it was more convenient to draw it this way, is shifting them vertically. This is achieved by applying voltage. If I apply voltage, then I'm going to have field states up to some energy above 0. But what is more practical, and what is actually done by Amir Jacobi, and what he did very successfully in his experiments with quantum wires, this momentum resolved tunneling in quantum wires, is changing the momentum difference between these curves, so shifting them right and left, not only up and down. Ideally, you certainly do both things, as he did. And now, why can I shift the stuff right and left? The reason is that the momentum is not just a built-in property of my electronic system. We know that the momentum actually contains two things. It contains the momentum operator P, and it contains the vector potential of the magnetic field. It knows about the magnetic field. So when you change the magnetic field, you actually constantly change the momentum difference between different things. You shift the curves right and left. And how it practically works, you would normally imagine that these two guys are not in exactly the same vertical position. This guy is actually somewhat higher or lower, and then you have an additional magnetic field, not only the one that points up and creates my quantum Hall effect, but also a magnetic field in this direction. You change it. You don't do much to your quantum Hall system, but you change the momentum difference between these two branches because, well, that magnetic field enters here. So that's the trick. So it's a nice trick. And then when I do that, it's very easy to see what happens. When I slightly change this curve in any direction, nothing is going to happen simply because tunneling requires both momentum and energy conservation. It can only happen where these two curves intersect. But they intersect at the point which is empty state for both subsystems. Nothing is not going to tunnel anywhere, even if an accessible state is allowed. But if I shift my curve really much, at some point I get an overlap of a field state and an empty state. That's where tunneling begins. Or I can shift it in the opposite direction, and I will again get overlap of this field state with this empty state, so I will get tunneling current in the opposite direction. So that's a very simple example. I have two threshold voltages. If I have more than two modes, I will get many more intersection points and many more interesting, much more interesting physics, but the bottom line is the same. At certain threshold values of momentum or voltage, I suddenly have some singularity in the IV curve, for example, a threshold, or something even stronger. It depends on the density of states. And then I'm quite happy because I can read out the information about my states. So to make long story short, because there are other things I want to discuss, and I see that I don't have much time, this just gives one example for one particular setup in which the Harvard group is most interested in. You can see that there are different numbers of singularities in different proposed states. The details are in this paper. I definitely have no time to go into more details here. The fact that these two have the same number of singularities is no big deal, both because these states are quite similar in terms of their statistics. It's almost the same statistics. So what notwithstanding. And also because the character of singularities is actually different, so you can distinguish them. So that's an I think. But this I think actually depends on the momentum conservation, which is a very non-trivial assumption. Straight edges are not enough. You should not have any disorder. And then, certainly, there is this huge nominal free mean path, which Eduardo Fradkin mentioned, which can be as huge as half a millimeter, but that's not what matters. The actual mean free path is probably no more than a few microns, which is still huge. But it still has to be seen if it's not enough for this experiment to be realized, or people need even cleaner samples. However, well, this nominal mean free path is something that's computed in the system without magnetic field, just two-dimensional guess. So you ask what is the path over which a particle moving in two dimensions would gradually turn 180 degrees. And this path turns out to be quite huge. But here I'm asking about something completely different. I'm asking about what happens in the condition of quantum Hall effect with a particle moving in a strong magnetic field over this edge. And then, if you wish, you can tell that disorder makes the edge not straight. That's a legitimate thing. You can tell that nothing actually happens to the particle. It strictly follows the edge, but the edge is not straight. Now, how much not straight it is? It goes this way. Ultimately, your particle may never turn 180 degrees. It's never going on. So this nominal scattering length is going to be infinite. But that's not what matters. What matters is how many of these ups and downs you accumulate, because gradually you just have some mismatch in the phases accumulated by particles that tunneled here and here, and that kills everything. So the momentum doesn't conserve because the edge is not straight. The nominal mean free path is actually infinite. Does it make sense? Good. So that's what happens here. And then the question is, okay, maybe I can even get rid of this requirement, because that's what experimentalists then ask me. Can I get rid of the requirement that there is no disorder, the answer is yes, sure, I can if you wish. So that's a different geometry where, as we see, I have tunneling only in 2 points. So I have filling factor 5.5 here, 2 here, nothing here and here. I have 2 tunneling contacts. Now, this seems to be pretty simplistic geometry. I apply some voltage here, something tunnels here between this edge channel and this edge channel, goes all the way here, tunnels back. I measure some current and noise here. In the simplest state, like integer Hall effect or Laughlin state, or so-called K equal to 8 state for this non-abelian system, this particular state, sorry, is abelian actually, I would not see anything interesting. It's exactly the same as Schottky experiment. I will see simply the charge carrier. And in this particular case, the only single outer tunnel is an electron or perhaps a group of several electrons. So all I can see is some integer number of electrons. Not very exciting. But if I consider more interesting states, like Pfaffian state, again I have this charge statistic separation phenomenon. So I have the charge mode, I have the neutral mode, which go at different velocities. And this makes a huge difference. If the velocity were the same, I would just see exactly the same as in the integer Hall effect. I would see the charge of a single electron. But the velocities are different. So when something tunnels from here to here and goes along this edge, it actually splits into charge and a neutral Majorana fermion. Charge arrives here. It may tunnel back. And if this was all I have, I would see the effective charge of a single electron. That's all I see. But I have another phenomenon. This Majorana fermion goes along the edge, arrives here. It doesn't carry charge. It cannot create current. But it carries energy, so it can create noise. This means that it can, with equal probability, stimulate a tunneling of charge from here to here or from here to here. On average, nothing is transmitted, but there is noise. There is an additional noise which results in some additional effective charge. So that's something nice, but still not very easy to measure. Much more interesting life emerges if we imagine states like so-called edge-reconstructed Pfaffian or anti-Pfaffian state, for which I don't have room here. In that particular case, the neutral mode actually runs in the direction opposite to the charge mode, and so you get backward noise. You apply some voltage here, charge tunnels here, and all charge goes here. But neutral mode can go backwards, induce some tunneling here, no current transmitted, only noise created. And then you do have some noise in this drain detected. So noise detected upstream. So that's a nice thing. And that's a much easier proposal to realize. So again, the details are discussed here. But then I have another reference, which is below the cut of the paper by Moti Heiblum's group from Weizmann Institute of Science, which was published in Science just a few months ago, where they did an even simpler experiment. So after they heard about that, they thought, haha, we can do something even simpler than that. Let me remove this contact. Let me just put an ohmic contact here, which serves as a source of the current. Now, naively, you would not see anything in that situation, because how a theorist approaches an ohmic contact? That's a source of all these edge modes and thermal equilibrium. And it doesn't matter where you put it, far or close, you don't see any signal. But that's a serious view. Experimentalists know that if you do something with your system, you create a lot of problems, which normally make all experiments not to work. But in this particular case, the problem is Joel heating, which is small, but as it turns out, not negligible in this situation. So what you do if you just put an ohmic contact here, you run charge in one direction, and you run slightly heated neutral mode in the opposite direction. And it would definitely lose its heat to the environment if it goes for a large time, but if it's very close, it doesn't. And what we see is some additional noise here, if suddenly you have this upstream mode. So that's what Moti Heiblum's group did, and that's what they saw. So there is this upstream noise, which was immediately interpreted as a proof of non-abelian statistics by the authors of the paper, because by that time there were only 2 proposals with such upstream modes, anti-Pfaffian state and naturally constructed Pfaffian. They have different statistics, but very similar to what I described. Suddenly, then theorists came and told, oh, wait a minute, we can write down an abelian theory with such upstream mode. So far you didn't prove anything. But if they can actually do this experiment, these 2-point contacts, this quite can prove everything, at least for the case of the anti-Pfaffian state, because it has a really bizarre feature of the noise in this geometry being dependent on the shape of this edge. You change slightly the shape of this edge, you get a completely different noise. So that's...
That wouldn't it be enough that they looked at to spend
that
it?
Would be, that would be, sorry?
Wouldn't it be enough if they looked at spin-dependent tunneling in the same place?
Spin-dependent tunneling in this geometry is not going to happen. Because, well, again, it depends on the state.
Yeah.
If the state is anti-Pfeiffian or actually constructed Pfeiffian,
mm-hmm.
then there is no spin-dependent tunneling here because everything is just spin polarized.
Right.
If it's three, one, there are two variants. One is spin polarized and nothing has seen, the other is spin unpolarized. But then you would tell that, okay, if that's your issue, just measure the total polarization of your sample.
Mm-hmm.
What it is? Well, that's what people cannot do. All optical experiments show 100%, all NMI experiments show 0%, all NMI experiments show 100%, all transport experiments show something that's understood as 50% or so. So that's where we are. Bar Yosef group did both NMI and optics, got 100% and 0%. So it's extremely difficult. It's maybe easy for theorists, but it's not that easy. Even theorists have a lot of controversies here. The story of this Mach-Zehnder is actually very instructive because there were quite a lot of incorrect papers on the topic. But for experiments, it's even way worse. So what I want to discuss, if I have time, I don't know. Time is running. There was just one more story I really wanted to mention because it's something new. We posted a paper on PONMAD, I think, a week ago. So I wanted to mention very briefly. So this is a completely different story, which can also be used for detecting upstream modes. But the main reason why I like it is some very general thermodynamic relation. It's a fluctuation dissipation theorem, which holds away from equilibrium, very far from equilibrium. You don't even have a single temperature in your system, provided suddenly that the system has no such upstream modes, that everything runs in one direction. So the structure of this expression is pretty similar to the structure of the standard Nyquist theorem, so let me explain what it means. So what I have here in this particular geometry, again, you can write it down in many geometries. You have some quantum system, a source, a drain. They are supposed to be ideal, that is, impedance to the outside world is zero, or huge boxes with enormous capacitance, an edge that connects these two guys, an edge that connects these two guys on top, you always have two edges. That's how you go around chiral anomaly and things like that. You obviously have two edges always. And then you have something else, which doesn't have to be a quantum Hall system even, and you have some tunneling from here to here. And then I claim that the noise detected in this drain and the noise detected in this conductor, they are related. This G is just quantum Hall conductance, so this is just the standard Nyquist noise of a uniform system for GT at low frequencies. That's what we know for some 80 years. That was observed by Johnson in 1927, I think, and explained by Nyquist very shortly after that. So his paper actually contains a major mistake. The correct derivation was obtained by Kuba way later. In the middle, there was a very strange derivation by Cullen and Burton. So it's a very interesting story. But anyway, now we know that we get this. And this is an interesting part because this is a nonlinear conductance. Normally, fluctuation dissipation relations have linear response. This is nonlinear response. Now, how does this come? When we think about the fluctuation dissipation theorem, it's based on two things. One is the Gibbs distribution, certainly. That's where I get a temperature from. But in this story, it becomes subtle because this sample is supposed to have some temperature. This source is supposed to have some temperature. But this contact may have a completely different temperature, and the place here is affected by both, so it doesn't really have any temperature. As it turns out, what enters is the temperature of the source in my story. But this Gibbs distribution is one part, and if everything depended only on it, I would never get any fluctuation dissipation theorem far from equilibrium, because I would not have a Gibbs. There is another part. This part is causality. Because fluctuation dissipation theorems connect fluctuations with response, causality is crucial for response. We know that future depends on the past. Past doesn't depend on the future. That enters the derivation. And now what happens here, if a system is chiral, if everything can go only in one direction along the edge, then I have a much stronger causality. Not only past doesn't depend on the future, but also right doesn't depend on the left. When I combine these two things, a small miracle happens, and I get a new fluctuation dissipation theorem. The derivation is actually not very complicated. an honest quantum derivation pretty much follows the line of the derivation of Huber formula. Also, at several critical junctions, we need to appeal to this chirality and stronger causality relation. But for that, I definitely don't have time. And I wonder if I have time for a very short and completely cheating classical derivation, which is based on a multiple application of the hand-waving operator. Do I have time for that, or do I have to stop?
We'll give you another 2 minutes.
Okay, I hope 2 minutes is enough. So that's my last by one slide. Oh, well, this slide has no the most important last line. But again, people have a lot of imagination here, right? You have the very top of the formula, right? Okay, let me try to go. I definitely can explain what is on the slide in 2 minutes. Okay. So, what's going on? What is this noise detected on this ring? It's the sum of two noises. One from this edge, the other from this edge. I add them. Now I ask what noise I detect from this edge. This edge is fine. It doesn't care about the lower edge. Its noise is exactly the same as if I didn't have this tunneling contact at all. Hence, it's just 1/2 of the noise I would have in this drain without this tunneling contact, which is 1/2 of the Nyquist noise. That's what I get. Now I have this second noise. And in order to understand what this second noise is, I need to appeal to the charge conservation. I definitely cannot accumulate charge in the middle of this edge. So the charge that arrives here must be a difference of the charge that's emitted here and the tunneling charge. So when I go to the low frequency components of the current, and I'm certainly speaking only about the low frequency noise, then I can claim that this I2 is actually the difference of these two guys. So that's how I know this noise. That's the charge conservation. I open the bracket, I see three things. One is the noise of the emitted current, one is the noise in this conductor, and the third part is some correlation of the emitted current and the tunneling current. Now, the noise in this conductor is what enters the final formulation. The noise of the emitted current, it has no clue about the tunneling contact again because of my enhanced causality. So it's again 1/2 of the Nyquist noise. And I am left with the cross-correlation noise. Now, how do I get it? Here one needs some imaginative use of the hand-waving operator, but really, essentially, it's a rigorous argument. Because I make the following statement. The tunneling current depends on two things. The voltage applied to the system, obviously, it depends on it. You have no voltage, you have no current. Well, but also it depends on the fluctuations of the incoming current from here. They must affect it. And with these fluctuations, I split them into two parts, slow and fast. What's the logic? The logic is that any physical system is supposed to have some relaxation time. It doesn't remember much about what happened before the relaxation time. So I tell that the slow part is slower than the relaxation time. Fast part is faster. But then if I claim that the slow part is slower than the relaxation time, then I have full right just to combine it with the applied voltage. Because this tunneling contact has no way to distinguish my applied DC voltage from the slow fluctuation. I combine them and that's it. Fast part stays here. Now let me just imagine for a second that I can get rid of fast part. Then everything is simple. It's just mathematics. Unfortunately, it's missing here. One cannot see it. But it's actually extremely straightforward. This fluctuating current is weak. So when I want to find the average current, I simply neglect it. And then everything is simple. I know what I get. When I want to find fluctuations, I certainly need to expand to the first order in this current, calculate the correlation function, and applying Nyquist formula, I get what I want. So everything is fine. The question is what's going on with this fast current. And that's certainly a problem. And that was a problem actually where I mistaken the original paper by Nyquist came. Because this fast current has fluctuations which cannot be described by a classical argument. And my argument is completely classical. Not only it has this form, but in fact most of its energy sees as the frequencies on the order of the temperature. So clearly this classical argument makes no sense then. It's both strong and it's quantum. And I am completely getting rid of it. That's what I'm doing. Well, the only thing I can do consistently in classical mechanics. Certainly, I could do slightly better. I could get rid of this noise at high frequencies comparable to temperature, still keep it at lower frequencies, and then tell it's already weak. I can already expand in the lowest order in this noise and get this expression I wrote. So maybe, but what am I going to do with high frequency harmonics? Other than ignoring them, there is no way for this hand-waving argument. But then I'm actually allowed to ignore them. And there is a simple physical reason for that. There is environment.
At the end of the day, if I am using classical argument, I already assume that there is no quantum correlations between here and here, environment like phonons arrays, etc. I also didn't write anything in the dependence of the current on other parameters other than the incoming current. I didn't write the incoming energy, for example. And I know why. These phonons are going to completely change it anyway. But for the same reason, I don't care about fast fluctuations of the incoming current. They are very different in neighboring points, at least in a system with a top gate, which, well, they need a few more, little more money to put closer. But then I don't care about high-frequency fluctuations, too. All I'm left with is exactly what's written here. So I get this relation. And now, certainly, you don't really need all this physical discussion. You can obtain things in a very formal way. This requires some quantum mechanics. For this, I definitely don't have time. So I just have to show my conclusions. And the bottom line is certainly that this fluctuation dissipation theorem is only established for chiral systems, so another way to search for upstream modes. And the bonus here is this really easy experiment, something that experimentalists actually did at very low temperatures, and I'm just asking them to raise the temperature. The request I really love. All people ask them to decrease the temperature. So what's my summary? So there is this exciting possibility of non-abelian anions in some quantum Hall states. There are a few ways to probe if they're around. On the theoretical part, we now have quite a few ideas. On the experimental part, it's certainly pretty tough. But some of them I discuss: interferometry, charge statistic separation, and the far from equilibrium fluctuation dissipation theorem. But my main message is simple. So if you're interested in the smallest particles in the universe, you need to go to the quantum Hall systems. Thank you.
Questions? Let me ask one. You didn't say what Amir Yacobi found.
In tunneling?
Yeah.
F5 half? Yeah. He didn't do it. I am not aware of the paper. He, in the winter at Santa Barbara meeting, he discussed what he found at the integer issue.
Okay, I thought he was looking.
No, it's still not 5.5. It was actually a little bit misleading. I thought that it was 5.5 first. Yes. I spoke to him. He told me, no, at this stage it's not 5.5. So he has 8 microns mean free pass. For integers, that's pretty nice. But in these systems, it's expected that the speed of neutral modes may be an order of magnitude. Well, it depends on whom you ask. But it may well be an order of magnitude lower than the speed of a charge mode. The charge mode is expected to be more or less fixed by Coulomb force on the order of, say, somewhat less than 10 to the 7 centimeters per second. But this neutral mode may well be some 10 to the 6 centimeters per second. And so there are a lot of complications. You want to see one thing on top of the other, so it's not that easy. Also, the charge mode may be slower. But what is important is not really the speed. The important thing is the gap. The gap is way lower. The gap is way lower. So this requires huge mean free passes. So all parameters are completely different.
Other questions? Then let's thank you again.